All right, folks, how you doing? This is NYC Radio Live. My name is David Ellenbogen. I am always honored that people choose to spend their time checking out this show. There's so much in the world, and I do my best to make sure that it's worth it. This episode is pretty cool. I've just been digging through the archives because I have a kind of neurosis, you know, that I feel that when I have great material and it's only on my hard drive, that it's not doing anything, and it should be in the world, meaning experienced by you. So here is one deep from the archives. I think it was a few years back. I did a show with a giant of kind of, what would you call it? Counterculture history? Let's call it that for now. There's a guy named Terrence McKenna who is the Carl Sagan of psychedelics. And if you don't know who Carl Sagan is, I strongly recommend you run out and check out his Cosmos special, which opened up astronomy to a billion people. Literally watched that, and it was one of the first times that scientists had the goal of reaching a big, wide audience of non-specialists. In fact, he was poo-pooed by many for even trying. And he's one of the most eloquent people ever. And Terrence McKenna is a guy who's linguistic skills were so mesmerizing, in his brother's own words, he could read the words, you know, he could read a phone book and people would be just spellbound. But he also is a very interesting thinker, and his area of expertise was psychedelics. And I just want to say right now, as a disclaimer, that while I find talking to these people very interesting, I don't want to seem like I'm advocating anything for anybody. You know, what you choose to ingest is your thing. And I interviewed Dennis McKenna twice, and actually, you know, he did speak of one potential downside of psychedelics, in his own words, is that people do them and they have amazing experiences. They might feel a oneness with all of the universe called a monism, monistic experience perhaps. And the mistake that some people might do is their next thought when they return is, oh, I've got to tell everybody about this, or I've got to bring this to the world. And that's where, you know, that's my mission, that's my job in life. And that's where he said, you know, kind of a little bit of a delusion of grandeur, or a kind of Christ savior complex might develop, you know. And I think some people get confused with these incredible experiences and they think that they might have something up on everybody, or they have something to bring to people. So, you know, if your issue is narcissism, then I don't know if psychedelics are necessarily the cure. And if your issue is you're not grounded, I'm not feeling grounded, I better, like, trip and think about this. I don't know. I don't know if that's the best approach. Maybe the best way to be grounded is, you know, I don't know, meditation or exercise or spending time with your family. So that's my disclaimer. I know a lot of people who've had very positive healing experiences, and so it's a little strange because this is mostly a music podcast, but I thought it was such an amazing discussion, and there's powerhouses that we're talking to. One is Dennis McKenna, the brother of Terrence McKenna, and an incredible scientist and one of the more grounded people in this field. Then Alexandre Tenue, who I introduced him in the podcast as a sound mystic. I mean, he certainly is. He's one of the most, he's on the foremost edge of sound and healing. And what, although he wouldn't use that term, just the potential of what sound can do with meditation, and he gets flown all around the world, giving talks, and really important guy, and Greg Barris, who's one of the great comedians of our day. And he explores a lot of these issues. So that's your warning. This show is just a discussion, but it gets really good. And in terms of radio, which is where this was originally broadcast, I feel like it gets more unhinged than just about anything I've heard on the radio. In fact, at one point, I just left. I was the host, and I just left them on their own to go answer the door. And so I had to listen back to hear what happens. But pretty wide-ranging, really funny discussion. And I think a lot of you will enjoy it. So here we go. This is Dennis McKenna, Greg Barris, and Alexandre Tenue on a radio show a couple years back entitled 3 Degrees of Terrence McKenna. Hope you enjoy it. Tons of music lined up and coming. I hope, put this date in your calendar. What is it? May 25th, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Rubin Museum. Our group, the Acoustic Mandala Project, is doing its CD release. So that'll be a good time to come and say hello. And that's always special at the Rubin Museum. Yeah. Okay. Here we go in our time machine back to one of the wilder radio shows I've ever done at WKCR. Enjoy. You're listening to WKCR 89.9 FM New York. My name is David Ellenbogen, and it pains me to turn that beautiful music off. However, we gave that show an extra 13 and a half minutes, so it was out of the love of our hearts. And also, out of the love of our hearts, we want to thank the host, Sriharsha. Say what's up, Sriharsha.
Thanks for listening, everyone. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, Sriharsha took over a show that we started, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. He took it over, and he did all the live Indian Raga stuff on KCR. Oh, he was involved with almost all of it for a long time. So yeah. That was a great service you did. Thank you. And now you're off to somewhere.
Somewhere, yeah.
Where are you going?
I don't know. One of these places. One of the two coasts. I will end up somewhere.
Ah, so humble. All right. He's going to Harvard or Princeton to do something with... You know, this guy's a scientist, too, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You don't have to be ashamed. In fact, you can stick around. You might ground this situation. Anyway, the show here, we have Dennis McKenna, who just wrote a book that there's a huge buzz around. In fact, it made the most money on Kickstarter as a crowdfunding for a book. So there's a lot of interest. It's called The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss. Welcome, Dennis. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, and it feels like a real radio show all of a sudden, right?
Indeed, it
Good.
Does.
And making it even that much more real, Alexandre Tenu, who he is a Renaissance man, I would say. I wrote on the website where that you are sound mystic, because I really think that. You don't have to agree or disagree, but I think you're a sound mystic and...
Or perhaps a sound wizard is a better...
A wizard, yeah. That's... Okay, fine. You're a sound wizard. And I also said that I think that you are on your own path of exploring where sound and meditation and healing meet. I mean, that's how you're spending your time, so that's a fair assessment. So welcome, Alexandre.
Thank you. Very happy to be here, David.
And rounding out our discussion is comedian Greg Barris. And I don't know, how do you introduce a comedian, right?
You need to usually say, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Barris.
Ladies and gentlemen. Oh, hold on. I have an app for that.
There's
Someone
an app?
Stall for time. Hold on.
It's kind of jazz you guys listen to on this station, right? Da-da-dee. Do do do.
Okay. So I used this when I was recently, thanks to Alexandre's influence, I went out to see these people who live in Mali, the Dogon people. You know about it. Dennis, you know about the Dogon people.
We know about the Dogon. Yeah.
Tell them a little about the Dogon and then I'll do what I...
No, Alexandre is the one. He's been there. I haven't.
Right. Okay, say a little about the Dogon people, and then I'll finish introducing
Those
Greg.
Dogon people.
Go ahead.
How much do you want me to say?
We only have an hour.
Yeah. It's very, very short amount, actually.
Very briefly. The Dogon are considered some of the most enigmatic tribes, most studied by anthropologists, because of their belief system and the enigmatic origins that they have. They now live on a mesa, long, huge mesa in northern Mali. You kind of encounter them on the way to Timbuktu. And they retreated and lived on the mesa. They're actually also called people of the cliffs because they took refuge in this mesa because they wanted to keep their animist religions.
So they're cliff-dwelling people out, kind of like the Anasazi people.
Exactly.
And you once told me that they are, I mean, even though they're in Western Africa, you said that they might have been from Egypt originally and were like a mystery school.
Right. They were a tribe of high priests that left Egypt because of radical change in the religious regime and belief, and they traveled through North Africa, settled for a bit in Libya, and continued their travel, eventually settled in Mali. And with the spread of Islam, when Islam went to West Africa, they were f- forcing everybody to convert, and those who didn't want to convert were taken as slaves. And the Dogons still now practice their animist religion, which is very esoteric, with very strange beliefs, have been able to preserve their animist religion, and they have a very complex system, agricultural system, and social, cultural, musical, and they were the first to tell Western astronomers about the existence of Sirius B, which is a tiny star that orbits Sirius A, the brightest star in the sky. And when the two Western astronomers in the late 40s checked this data after having been able to verify it using powerful telescope, and that's a star you can only see with a telescope,
right.
They saw that it was there for real. And they asked them, well, how do you know about this? These are people who still now don't have electricity, and they're completely removed from society and culture, even in a beautiful third world country. They said, well, extraterrestrials told us about it thousands of years ago, and it's been kept in their belief system, and there's a whole construct around it. It was not just a story.
Right, so that's the hook. Yeah. They thought that they were visited by aliens who lived on a star, the brightest star in the sky, Sirius.
The Nomos people.
But they also thought that it was more than one star. It was a binary star system.
There are actually three stars. Mm. If you consider the other one that's next, you know, that gets complicated there. But
right. So maybe they were wrong. Mm. So anyway, I was visiting the Dogon people earlier this year, and usually I have an instrument, and that's my big icebreaker. I can go play music anywhere in the world, and people are charmed, dancing, whatever, so far. But I didn't have anything, and I had a really bad guide who just wanted to go off, and I don't know if he was drinking or what, but he just wanted to get rid of me. So he'd just drop me off. Like, I think he'd pretend the motorcycle was broken, like kick me off somewhere and then like disappear and drink with his buddy. So I would walk around. I got led to a family of Fulani herders. Fulani, mm-hmm. Some people say they're like the African Jews in that they are really, really widespread throughout all West Africa. Herdsmen and traders. And so I got brought to these Fulani people, and it seemed like the hustle was they wanted me to buy a chicken. Like, that was the whole hook. Like, okay, you're here. Like, when are you going to buy the chicken, you know? Like, and I'm like, oh, man, I don't want to buy a chicken, you know? So this is how I'm going to introduce Greg Barris. I used this app, and I said, oh, it's really great to be here. I'm like, oh, but I'm just kidding.
I like that app. Yeah, I should
you
have
need that.
What's that called?
It's 70s. It's, I don't know. But it's a 90s sitcom or something. So it has things from 90s.
That's perfect.
Times.
I just need that all the time.
Like, hey, girl.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so.
That's perfect.
Dennis, you wrote a book. It just came out. And you said I can only ask questions in good taste. But
that's right.
All right. I'll do my worst.
Standards vary.
Right. In a book that you are a fictional character in, perhaps, you go out to the Amazon. You were in search of a rare psychedelic. You didn't find it, but you found an incredible amount of mushrooms. You guys ate them.
That's right.
And you discovered a sound. A sound that blasted you into another
dimension. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, that's kind of the capsule version of the idea. We went to the Amazon in search of a new hallucinogen that nobody had ever heard of called ukuhe, which was used by the Witoto people, which is the ancestral home of the Witoto is this place called La Chirera in southern Colombia. So that's what took us to La Chirera, was our search for this hallucinogen called ukuhe. Why were we looking for ukuhe? We were looking for it because we were interested in DMT. It was really DMT that was the hook, if you will, that fascinated us when we were in growing up or not growing up, whatever it was we were doing back in the late 60s in Berkeley and the Haight-Ashbury and all that. And my brother was going to Berkeley at that time and was heavily involved in the drug culture, and out of all the panoply of drugs that were available, DMT emerged as by far the most interesting to our point of view, because it seemed to be a portal into hyperspace, in a sense. We became convinced that DMT was far more than just a drug, that it had something to do with aliens. We weren't quite sure, but the content of the experience was very, you know, indicative of that, very science fictional, and so on. But the problem with DMT itself is it's so short-acting that you can't really get much out of it other than astonishment. I mean, you can bring back loads of astonishment from a DMT trip, but beyond that, it's hard to suss out what it was really about. So we came up with this idea that if we could find an orally active form of DMT, it might last longer, and we might have a chance to get our sea legs, if you were, and kind of stay in that dimension a while and figure out what was going on. So when we basically stumbled across a paper by the famous ethnobotanist R.E. Schultes, which was called Varola as an orally active hallucinogen. And Varola is a genus of trees in South America in the nutmeg family that is used to make snuffs that various tribes use, the Yanomami primarily, and the snuffs are very high in DMT and other related compounds. But this one tribe that Schultes was writing about, the Witoto and the Bora, which is a close related tribe, were not using it as a snuff. They were making an orally active preparation out of it. And so we thought, aha, this has got to be the Holy Grail. We should go after Ukuhe, because this is, you know, this is the DMT formulation that you know, we think may do the trick. So that turned out to be a red herring in some ways. When we finally got to La Chirera, eventually we laid our hands on Ukuhe, and it was interesting but not spectacular. But what happened was really sort of serendipity. When we went through all this trouble to travel down there, quitting our... Well, we didn't actually have jobs at the time. We were students. But when we went down to South America in search of Ukuhe and went through a great deal of trouble to get to La Chirera, what we found was that the area around the mission village where we were had been cleared for pasture, and these white Cebu cattle had been brought in. There's maybe 100 acres of pasture around this little town, and that's the preferred substrate for Psilocybe cubensis, which is a mushroom, psilocybin mushroom that everyone knows about now. But nobody really knew much about it at that time. So when we got to La Chirera, these mushrooms were everywhere. And we thought, well, this is great. You know, these are nice, friendly, recreational psychedelics. We can entertain ourselves with these while we're looking for the real mystery, not knowing that the real mystery was really mushrooms. And that is the best orally active form of DMT that there is. And so we, you know, psilocybin and DMT are very closely related on the chemical mm-hmm. level, on the molecular level. So we started eating this mushroom with quite regularly. And actually, we kind of incorporated into our diet, because there wasn't a whole lot of other things to eat there. And it quickly got very strange. One of the things that mushrooms does is they make you have funny ideas, and many funny ideas began to float around in our conversation.
Now, my friend here, who has remained, I'm very impressed, because he's an incredible scientist, and I know you are as well. So can you explain to him a little about what your take on the chemistry of what was happening to your brain or your mind as you're eating these plants?
Well, no.
No, you don't know. You don't know.
Well, we don't really know. I mean, I think there's more to it than just molecular processes. But one of the things about mm-hmm. DMT is it's not orally active. You know, as a rule, it's not orally active, right? You have to ingest it other than by mouth, either as a snuff or the usual way to take it, if it's synthetic, is you smoke it in a crack pipe. You smoke it as the free base.
But okay, now I have to say, this show is not officially representing the views of Columbia University or the people who give Columbia University money.
No, we understand that.
Yeah.
And we're not even necessarily recommending this.
Yeah.
I should have said a glass pipe. That's less.
Right. I mean, we lost a lot of credit with the aliens. But go ahead. now we're on crack
pipe. The point is that DMT by itself, you can't take through the gut because there are enzymes in your stomach and your liver that will inactivate it. These monoamine oxidase inhibitors, or monoamine oxidases is what they're called. So if you want to take DMT orally, you have to take a monoamine oxidase inhibitor with it. And it turns out that that's the basis of the formulation of ayahuasca. Most people know this who are familiar with ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is made with two plants, one of which contains DMT, the other one contains monoamine oxidase inhibitors. So if you take either one separately, not much happens. In fact, nothing happens. If you boil them together, then you get a powerful hallucinogenic brew. But at the time that we went down there, this really hadn't been worked out for ayahuasca. Ayahuasca was much more mysterious at that time.
You mean some tribe was keeping it to themselves?
Well, it's not like that, but the chemistry of it wasn't well understood. It wasn't understood about this admixture plant business, the synergy between the two plants. The early ethnobotanists, mostly Schulte's students at that time, were beginning to find out that there were other plant components in ayahuasca that really gave it the activity, but this wasn't available to us. This information wasn't published. So we sort of went off in this other direction when we stumbled across this paper about Varola, and we thought, well, that's must be the perfect orally active form of DMT. Let's go after it. So that's what took us to La Chorrera. And then when we got there, it became apparent in pretty record time that the real mystery and the thing that we'd come for was actually the mushrooms, which are very great psychedelics. They're very compatible with human metabolism, non-toxic, all of this. And they don't require a monoamine oxidase inhibitor to be active. The nature of the active molecule in the mushrooms, which is psilocybin is converted to psilocin in the body, and it's psilocin that actually is the active form. But psilocin is very, very close to DMT, but just different enough that it's not broken down by monoamine oxidase. So it's orally active, and it's very compatible with our metabolism. It basically goes through you like ice water, except you shouldn't probably eat it every day.
Yeah. That's where things took a turn.
That's where things took a turn because, it began to, many funny ideas about what all this was about. One of the things that psilocybin brings front and center is kind of questions about language. It's almost that it makes verbal activity much more real, almost visible in a certain sense. So there was this sense of communication with some other entity that was either the mushroom or communicating through the mushroom, and that intelligence, whatever it was, began to suggest certain ideas about certain things you could do using the sounds that we could hear inside our head on large doses of mushrooms. And so we sort of quickly went down this primrose path of we devised this experiment. And the experiment involved trying to imitate the sounds that we could hear inside of our heads and induce essentially a biophysical reaction. Well, now it really gets complicated because I can't really talk about the experiment at La Chorrera. I mean, the whole
hour. Fair enough.
Yeah. But anyway, we got led into this place where we had some very funny ideas about what we could do with mushrooms and our own voice to create, what do you call it, the ultimate artifact, something like a fusion of mind and matter.
Through sound.
Through sound, right.
Ah, and that's where we come in with...
Where Alexandre comes in.
Well, it shouldn't be that strange, because Hindus and Buddhists have been doing this for centuries and thousands of years, if not older, you know, in other religions, which is using mantras and sutras that are actually words to change the tuning of the brain. A lot of the open-minded scientists right now think that the brain is a receiver of consciousness, and this is not where consciousness is made. The brain taps into consciousness, and with sound and compounds and plants and hallucinogens, you can adjust this tuning. And some use both plants and sound. So monks use a whole repertoire of sutras and mantras, which are actually word, and altering consciousness is a practice that has existed in many other cultures using music. You were just playing Indian classical music. The main thing that happens in an Indian classical music performance is altering people's consciousness, the listeners or the audience, through judicious, attentive listening. Same thing with classical Arabic music, Persian and Turkish. When you deal with scales, modes, makamat and raga, these are names for various modes in different cultures, you're dealing with different mathematical proportions and ratios. So these also alter chemicals. So there are many different ways to tap into what the brain can allow you to experience.
So Sriharsha, as someone who spent a lot of time in the field of raga, do you think that it's possible that a different tuning system, like each raga is its own color, do you think it's possible that each raga could tune your body in a certain way?
Well, I don't know to what extent, but different ragas do try to evoke different aesthetics, what is called the rasa. So some evoke a feeling of pathos, some evoke a feeling of anything from fear to amazement to a devotional to spiritual feeling. So that, I'm sure, happens. Whether you get a response beyond just a temporary altering of your feelings into something physiological, that I'm not sure. But ragas do definitely change your mood, for sure.
Well, that's one and the same, don't you think? I mean, if something changes your mood, it changes you physiologically, I would say, to some extent.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you're in agreement. You're really losing credit here. You seem to be in agreement with the group on the whole.
Yeah, and when your mood changes, it changes on the chemical level. Anything that happens in us changes on the chemical level.
Right.
And then emotions and your mental state would change, your physical state. We run on chemicals, as Dennis always say.
And right. Essentially, what we even call consensus reality is a drug-induced state, because, you know, reality is created, or at least filtered, by our brains. And our brains are biochemical engines that run on neurotransmitters. Those things are drugs, basically. So we're all high on something all the time, right? The concept of the drug-free person, it's an oxymoron. It doesn't exist, because we're made of drugs, right? And you can modulate consciousness through these different molecular tweaks, in a sense, these molecular triggers. And if, as Alexandre mentioned, if consciousness is... you know, a quality of the continuum, essentially, a quality of reality. It's not that the brain creates it. The brain detects that signal, filters it, and processes it, and extrudes the movie that we live inside, you know, the reality hallucination. and you can change the channel, and that's partly what some of these compounds do. They let you temporarily change the channel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, and music too, right? I mean,
of course.
And laughter too. That's right. Why people go to comedy shows, because endorphins are some of the most magical.
Right.
Yeah, I'm a good trip, for real. Yeah, let's... You've been holding back, so comedy. Let's get to it.
Well, comedy's interesting. I mean, is no other primate that we know about laughs, right? I mean, sense of humor is a uniquely human quality, is it not?
Dolphins laugh. Dolphins laugh. Well, they got a good sense of humor.
There goes that.
Do they have good jokes?
They have some pretty good jokes.
Oh, tell us a dolphin joke.
Okay. Right, it's a little dirty for the radio.
That's
but
real funny.
Surprised you didn't bleep me out.
You always tell the same joke.
You guys keep talking. My next guest is trying to come in. So
oh, wow.
Take over.
So, let's...
Tell us about dolphins.
Yeah, I don't know so much about dolphins. I got into dolphins because I was into John Lilly, and who invented the sensory deprivation tank and is a big... Did you know John Lilly? Did you ever meet him?
I never met John Lilly.
I'm a big fan of his.
I mean, I admire his work. He was a real pioneer in this whole area, for sure.
You ever do a ton of mushrooms and get inside a sensory deprivation tank?
Can't say I have.
Wow, you'd think
I'd have a lot of things on my map that I probably don't.
Man, what's top three weird things you've done? We can all go down the line.
Top three weird thing. Well, I'd have to put DMT up there somewhere.
Yeah, sure.
I think Salvia divinorum is quite bizarre. I mean, it's far too bizarre for me to handle. Datura, nightshade.
Well, how did you do that?
Datura?
Yeah.
Well, embarrassingly, accidentally.
You thought it was Pepsi.
Yeah, well, no. When I was 16, my friend and I were ready to experiment with about anything. And, we weren't very cautious. We were not observing the usual procedures that you should follow with drugs of this kind. We were basically ready to try whatever came to hand. And we had been experimenting with morning glories because morning glories had been reported to contain the lysergic acid derivatives, which they do. So morning glory seeds, if you take enough of them, you can have a kind of an LSD-like experience. So we had been... we'd gone to the garden store and bought heavenly blue seeds and ingested them and didn't really get very far. We got an upset stomach and that was about it. But there was a bush that grew in a vacant lot in the town that I lived in, and it had big white flowers, and I stupidly thought that it was a kind of morning glory. This is how bad a botanist I was at the time. I had no idea what I was doing, but I thought this was moonflower, which is a kind of morning glory. So I thought, well, the ones that we bought at the garden store didn't do much, but let's give these a whirl. So we went and collected the seeds. Well, turns out that was Datura. That was what people call Jimson weed. So we ingested these seeds, expecting to have an acid-type experience, and instead what we had was a completely typical Datura-like experience, which, on the conceptual model we were working under, it was a bad acid trip, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we'd only taken acid once before in our lives, so we thought, oh, this is what they mean by a bad trip. No, this is what they mean by a typical Datura trip, which is pretty horrific, actually. I don't recommend it. People should not.
I trust you. I trust you. If you tell people to do something.
Well, don't do it.
Well, let's get the list.
Right. Well,
how long was your Datura trip?
Oh, about 36 hours. It's long, and we took a very substantial dose. And Datura is, I sometimes tell my students, it's not a psychedelic, but it's a true hallucinogen. And by that I mean you actually see hallucinations. On psychedelics you see things, but you usually know that they're not real. On Datura you see things and you can't tell if they're real or not.
Wow.
And in fact, 36 hours.
Well, in this case, more or less, yeah.
Isn't that also like witch hazel? Isn't that what witch hazel is?
No, witch hazel is something hazel. Completely okay, different, yeah. But Datura is and nightshades.
Nightshade.
Datura is a nightshade. It definitely was used in European witchcraft.
Yeah, right.
It's also the basis of a lot of brujeria in South America. The so-called tree daturas, which in South America are known as toé, are also used very much in shamanic practices down there. But by people who know what they're doing or think they know what they're doing, not by 16-year-old kids who didn't know anything. You know?
Yeah, you're lucky. So you didn't go blind or something.
Yeah, exactly. We were lucky that we got through that one.
Yeah, some people don't come back from these things, right?
And then 2 weeks after we took it, I was flipping through a botany book, and I stumbled on a picture, and it was this plant. It was exactly this plant. And I realized, this is Datura stramonium or Datura metal or whatever it was, not a morning glory. And it was actually a transitional point in my life because I realized at that point I said, if you're going to work with these plants, you better damn well know what they are. So I decided to study botany so I wouldn't go around mistaking plants.
Wow.
You know.
That's commitment.
It was self-preservation, really.
Well, and the guy who led you through all this, which was supposed to be the theme that I didn't make clear, except on the website, is that your brother, who you were with, became pretty damn famous.
Mm.
And some of those bad ideas, as well as the good ones, exploded into popular consciousness. Your brother was Terence McKenna, who,
that's right.
If people just Google him, you can find tons of speeches. And he is one of the most extemporaneously eloquent people I've ever heard in my life. Even when he's completely off base.
Oh,
yes. It's even more interesting.
Right, right. I mean, one of the great things about Terence was that he didn't have to make sense, you know. It was the voice. That was the thing. It was the voice. I used to kid him that, you know, he could read the phone book and people would sit enraptured, you know. It wasn't what he was saying. And he used to hate to have me come to his seminars because I'd be the only person that would stand up and challenge him. You know?
One of those, I think you'd agree with me, bad ideas maybe, was that the 2012 thing got really escalated, I think partially because of his influence,
yes,
right?
He was kind of
the guy that sprung 2012, like, you know.
That's right. I mean, he was part of the guy that partly responsible for putting this meme out there. I think if he had not come up with 2012, probably people with an interest in the Mayan calendar and all that, because that's the other direction that this thing came from. But Terence, because he was so widely quoted and sort of out there promulgating this idea of the time wave and the idea that time is going to end, I mean, he loved provocative statements.
It's great to think about time, right? I mean, no matter, even
time.
If it's off base, to have a really fascinating guy talk about different ways time could work.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of worth it.
And some of his ideas about time were pretty interesting.
All right, like what?
Know? Well, the idea that time has a structure, you know, that time is a fractal structure, you know, just a
fractalated reverberation of some beginning time point.
Yeah, in a sense.
There we go.
Time actually can condition
a fractalated
time. Time actually determines what kind of things can happen within time. And the theory was all about novelty. You know, novelty is new things under the sun, if you will. You know, novel events, not habitual events.
Okay, let's bring in our non-psychedelic explorer besides me. I'm the host, and the views expressed do not necessarily reflect WKCR or Columbia University or its affiliates.
Or distinctly don't reflect.
Yeah. These are the opposite of what they're trying to tell us.
Right.
Which is why I'm bringing in Sriharsha. You like that idea that time could be a fractal? And what he's saying, time creates time itself?
I'm sure time is a very interesting topic, as is the complexity of all the biological phenomena that's being discussed here. But I'm I'm not sure. I would just say that there is enough that is not known to speculate, but nothing to say.
It's a fun idea. It's worth kind of spending some time on.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
It's worth spending time thinking about time.
There we go. It's a fractal.
Well, I like the idea that if many people think that time exists for things not to happen all at once.
Right. If there was no time, everything would happen at once.
Yeah.
And this was kind of the basis of Terence's theory. I mean, the idea that time sets boundary conditions on the kinds of things that can happen, this really goes to the ideas of Alfred North Whitehead, who was, mm-hmm. you know, a pretty credible guy, a mathematician, and he wrote, his philosophy was all about process and how do events happen, and he talked about how does novelty ingress into the continuum. How does something actually undergo, you know, if we live in a, think of yourself as living in a matrix where all possibilities are possible, but only certain things happen, right? So why do certain things happen when potentially anything could happen? And Whitehead spent a lot of time thinking about that. How does something undergo the formality of actually occurring? That's what he talked about. And Terence said that time has an energy, that time actually determines this, and that you can measure it and quantify it. And that's what the time wave is supposedly about. And it was based on certain mathematical properties of the I Ching, this oracle.
See, that's where I think it started slipping away a little bit.
Right, right.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe I speak in ignorance. Alexander, someone tell me more about the I Ching.
I Ching is just a way to like figure out what this exact moment in life means, right? I mean, it's like it only works for this one particular moment, and that's it. And then, you know, there's like 64 hexagrams, right?
And 64 as a number is very magical. Well, let's not go further into this because
okay, all right,
more
I stand corrected. Then
but
all
it's
right,
a fascinating
good.
Topic. I think, but it's really complicated, and to give the listeners just 2 minutes of
okay,
this topic
so buy a book on the I Ching. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah.
At least the host should.
Yeah.
Wing Chun. Wait, what is it?
But I would say
everybody.
What Terence did with the I Ching was actually, as you mentioned, the I Ching is an oracle. It's a method of divination to tell what's happening at this exact moment, right? But Terence was able to extend that into a mathematical system, and essentially what he did was rediscover an ancient calendar. Mm-hmm. I think that much is clear.
So he found out that there's a relationship between the I Ching and the Mayan calendar?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, it's its own calendar. Okay. It's actually...
It is a calendar.
You can use it as a very accurate 13-month lunar calendar. And if he'd stopped there, then he would have got recognition from a lot of sinologists who would have been amazed at this discovery, and no one else would have noticed or cared, right?
He got, like, recognition from the wrong people outside the economy. But actually, that will probably help his star is only rising. Like, people are still talking about him more after his death than before. Is that true?
That seems to be true.
Yeah. So... Yeah. I know, Alexander, you're another guy that just got out of the academics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't think it was a good place for ideas.
No, because people are so conditioned and that it's so hard for them to think outside of the box. And anyone who thinks outside of it is kind of excommunicated or at least highly encouraged not to.
Right.
And I think it's healthy to be open-minded and to do some research, to investigate things further, to see whether they're possible or not, because what drives this reality and our future is invention, and that means bringing new information, new ideas. If we bathe in the familiar all the time, we don't go...
So you think you get more ideas outside of a place where a unification of ideas is encouraged?
Yeah, exploration, invention, creation, creativity is the most important tool. And this is what artists, scientists, inventors rely on.
And you can't pursue this in an academic context?
With great limitations based on what the group thinks is correct. So
I guess you just shot down your application for tenure.
Well, I...
you didn't no, put no, one... No. Oh, you forgot to put one in.
No.
Greg, you went to school?
I was a philosophy major.
Me too. Nice.
I dropped out.
Okay.
My senior year, and I had a scholarship. I just left it all.
Wow, you're like, that's mystical. And now, you know what's weird about you? You're a comedian. Greg Barris is a name. They're offering you big halls. You said something like Irving Plaza or something, right?
Sure.
Yeah. He's playing big halls. That's hard. Comedy is the most brutal sport. It's almost a sport, right?
It's a sport.
You get abused.
Cheerleading's a sport. Comedy's a sport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whew. But what's strange about you is... The comedians, I always imagine comedians have to be the kind of like the lovable loser schmuck guy. You know, like the Woody Allen, you know, like, oh, the poor guy. But you have like a restaurant. It's kind of strange. It kind of strikes down the, you know, it's a different genre.
Yeah, what can I say? I'm a man for all seasons, you know. I can't help but kill it everywhere I go. And, you know,
all
that's
right.
Just a part of it.
Well,
I mean, what do you want from me? I try to
just
be
share.
A lovable douchebag, but I just come across as awesome.
You can't help it.
Oh, wow. Can you believe that it's almost time to wrap it up?
Oh, man.
Would you believe that?
That was a quick hour.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
There you go. Fractal time.
Fractal time. It was really like a lot of hours, but
right.
Just fractalated.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And then it will continue.
Because especially, let's say we listen back to the recording. Then what's happening to time?
Exactly. Well, maybe that's what happened on the 21st. I was thinking that, because one of the speculations that there could be time travel on the 21st, right? And
right.
If someone did time travel, we wouldn't be like cognizant of it, right? I mean, how would we be? Like if someone time traveled and like...
Well, Terrence's, one of his wilder speculations on what might happen on the 21st was... You know, a kind of funny scenario. It was that would be the moment when time travel was invented.
Yeah, the first time.
Right. But of course, if time travel were invented at that time, then after that, all the time machines from the future, of course, you'd want to go back as far as you could. Well, you can't go back earlier than the moment time travel is invented. Right.
Yeah.
So one of his scenarios was that suddenly on the 21st, all of these time machines would start
just show up, right?
Show up. There would be time machines everywhere, like mosquitoes or something. And you know, that would signify the end of the temporal world, the beginning of a historical.
Yeah, or at least we'd see like a lot of like time travel tourists. Popping up,
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Wanting to check out, like, oh, let's go to that radio interview from 2012,
exactly.
13,
exactly.
13.
I mean, if you had a time machine, you'd want to go back.
You'd want to be here
you'd
right now.
You'd want to go ahead, but you'd want to go as far back as you could to see
Definitely.
The origins of the whole thing. So all these tourists would show up. Yep.
So I don't know.
That would be a shocker, but that didn't happen.
Didn't happen.
So, no.
Such a. I know it wasn't a letdown for you, but I feel... Just devoted
it
so much of my life to it.
It wasn't actually a letdown for me. I didn't think anything was going to happen. I was always a skeptic about time wave zero. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the problem was, well, there's not time to get into it, but the basic problem was it couldn't be disproven. You know,
yeah.
So it's not a legitimate theory unless you can define how you can invalidate it. That's kind of the essential quality of a real
I got
theory.
Into it. Artwork. I made artwork, jewelry, a psychedelic rock song about it, a television pilot. It's all a lie.
Yeah. So in that sense, it was interesting.
Got me.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Got lots of people.
Well, it was cool. It's a cool. It's super cool idea.
Yeah.
So, gentlemen, this actually happened. It was a beautiful radio show. Very, you don't know who is listening, but it's great. In New York, people actually are listening.
Okay.
Maybe that's a bad thing.
Great.
I don't know. Go ahead.
Are you going to plug my book?
Yes. Oh. Yeah, I know. I was just going to get to that part
of
the show. But I have to say, I think this is the first. I think I'm doing something new in radio in that I've never heard the host leave to go answer the door. Have you?
No. Some people would say unprofessional, but other people could say trailblazer. You know.
Thanks. I think so. That's the direction things are going in. Right?
Yeah.
Right.
So yes, if you want to learn more about Dennis and his adventures, you can go to the Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss.com. Is that possible?
Well, you can go there, but you can buy it on Amazon.
Just buy it. Yeah, buy the book.
That's where you want to go. Is
buy the
Amazon.
Book.
Yeah.
If you want to experience a sound healing, which is a beautiful, beautiful experience, I think the term Alexandra prefers is a sound meditation. How do they do that? I don't even know. You have to know them, right?
Well, they can connect to me on
He's
Facebook.
Much tougher.
Yeah, look for Alexandra Tanu, yeah. But write a message that you—that's why you're connecting with them.
T A N N O U S.
And it's pronounced Alexandre.
It's A L E X A N D R E Tanus. T A N N O U S.
But it just kind of disappears, Alexandre.
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 Yeah. But I just...
Are you going to wrap up the show?
Okay, okay. All right. Finally, and how do we keep in touch with...
Oh, I'm easy. I mean, if you just put Greg Barris in any type of media device you have, I'm all of it comes up.
Just go to Carnegie Hall.
Go to CarnegieHall.com, yeah. Type my name in, buy tickets, buy my album, buy a shirt.
Okay.
Bye.
And now...
Go to his restaurant.
Buy something. Please. Buy something. Please, God, I need money.
All right. So, now, to end with some shameless self-promotion, my favorite singer, who you guys know, Dana Hanchard,
yes.
Beautiful singer.
Yes, she
She's
is.
Playing the Zinc Bar, which is on 3rd and Sullivan, tomorrow, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. She's my favorite musician because, honestly, I cry sometimes when I listen to her.
She does have a phenomenal voice.
And I'm playing at the show.
Fantastic.
I know. Yeah, it's going to be great. Some African musicians are coming, all kinds of people. So I'm going to play one tune, and then that will move us over into the next program. Thank you, Sriharsha, for a beautiful service to lovers of music. And
thank you. And after listening to all of this, my state of consciousness has definitely been altered.
All right. Here's Dana Hanchard.
blue.